sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The dollar has the longest rally since 2012. Geopolitical tensions, no worry for U.S. investors. The Jackson Hole Confab offers no real insight. And our guest today, Ronnie Moas from Standpoint Research, talking about the blacklist. All this and much more on episode number 378 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello and welcome. Andrew Horowitz here. It is episode number 378. It's the end of August, approaching the last and final week of August, and a lot of surprises in the markets during this period. It seemed that we were looking at some real drops and a change of trend, and all of a sudden, bam, there you go. No more worries. We had so much geopolitical and concerning factors about economics in the beginning of this month, and all of a sudden the markets did in fact come in about 3-4% in terms of the S&P 500, the Dow, and all of a sudden here we are. We have a new record on the S&P 500. Pretty amazing. Pretty amazing when you think about all the things that are going on with the S&P now at a PE about 17 and a half or so, looking at questionable outlook for many companies, but yet earnings have been standing up very nicely. A lot of M&A that's going on. As a matter of fact, if you remember last week, we talked about that monster deal with Coca-Cola. This week, we saw that now Kraft is going to be doing a deal with Green Mountain. It shot the stock up by about 13-14% for Green Mountain on Friday. And this is something that's going on in a lot of different areas as companies that have generally, we'll call it average growth, not the go-go's by any chance, but your average growth companies that are the staples. We see like the Coca-Cola, now the Kraft, looking to buy growth, looking to find ways that they can accentuate their long-term strategy and continuing growing their earnings, because the revenue has been pretty much flat on some of these, and there's some global issues that are causing that. There is some currency issues that are causing that. And there's just a saturation overall with some of these companies, and they're wondering, hey, what are we going to do? Are we going to come up with a new product? Okay, we could do that. Are we going to go out and add to our distribution sales? Well, maybe. But what they can do is find other products, like we talked about in the biotech, and we talked about this last week at length, that they can find to fold in and then do what they can to enhance the distribution. If you think about this, the difference is that Kraft did not put the money into Green Mountain like we saw that Coke put the money into Monster Beverage, but at the same time, it's a very similar kind of deal, whereas the product from one and the distribution force from one, the big boy, the Kraft, the Coca-Cola, now has additional products that can be distributed through other methods. The Kraft deal is a little different in that they're going to use their coffees, like the Maxwell House brand, etc., to be put into the Keurig in the machines and distributed that way. And this is going to allow them to have an additional outlet for their particular product, where the Monster deal was that the Monster beverage now will be put through to the Coca-Cola sales force and the distribution methodologies that they use and gather an additional revenue source from that. So we are seeing some very interesting and I would say some ways that companies are being very, very creative to find additional growth. So that is also helping the markets. One of the things that I think is most interesting is the additional geopolitical risk that continues to expand. Now we're talking about not only do we have some boots on the ground in Iraq, which the government seems to want to not at all play up, which we know why, but also now we're talking about potentially going after ISIS in Syria and doing some bombings there. Now, there's a big difference in going into Syria than there was what we did with Iraq. In Syria, The problem is that we're not invited. We're not being asked for help. We're going to go in there if we do, and it's going to be basically breaking the sovereignty of the airspace and the ground and the people there in a country that is not requesting any help from the United States, whereas we were essentially asked to help in Iraq due to all the human suffering and all the problems that's going on with the terrorist organizations and these various factions that are isolating the Iraqis from food and from water and from all the things they need, and showing a real humanitarian problem because of the occupation and basically preying on civilians. So it's a much different situation. We'll see how that plays out. I don't think this is an easy decision at all for the U.S. government here. And this is also going to be a problem because it brings in and folds in Russia again as our, well, not the ally, but not our enemy, on the other side. Essentially, as you know, that Russia is an ally with Syria, provides them with all sorts of weaponry, but also is a close trading partner. That's going to be further problems with the tensions that are now going on with Russia and the U.S., not to mention the fact there's been some scuttlebutt about the fact that the humanitarian aid that went over the border into Ukraine from Russia was nothing more than troops that were amassing in Ukraine by the Russians and helping out some of the folks there. And this is going to continue to be this ebb and flow of concern, fear, and problems, and it's going to end somewhere in time. But before then, I assure you, we're going to see that markets are going to be very skittish, and then buyers are going to step in, then we're going to see more problems, and we'll see how this ends. But there'll be a crescendo somewhere in all of this. Right now, we are seeing that also news out of Jackson Hole. This is the annual meeting of economists, we'll call it. Central banks also attend this big meeting in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And what happens is a lot of speeches and some announcements. And it's been a traditional place where we do see that there are policy changes, announcements, enhancements that go on a regular basis. Now, this year, we did see that on Friday, Janet Yellen, the chair of the Federal Reserve, did speak and talked about how there was still a concern about the slack in the labor markets. But there was some others that were speaking as well, saying that we may see a much faster increase in rates and a much more, and the rate increase will happen a lot sooner than was expected. This concern that the economy is picking up speed in such a way that there is growth underlying all of it. And the fact of the matter is that there will need to be a change in policy. Now, Janet Yellen, when she did start speaking and her speech was released, markets were not very happy about that because there was some quote-unquote good news in there about the economy. Essentially, markets are looking for liquidity. Markets are looking for bad news because bad news brings on more central bank stimulus of sorts. In fact, if we tally up all of the conversations and speeches and announcements slash the policy discussions that were made and had at Jackson Hole, probably we could say that overall, there's still a tremendous amount of dovishness that central banks are exuding, still saying that there is a great need in the economies around the world for stimulus and for low rates, and that there is still a feeling that they're not going to pull out at this point. I don't know if central bankers at this point have the ability or really the desire to do anything more than what they're doing now in terms of keeping the rates as low as possible. I don't know what would cause a change to that. It doesn't seem that they're able to change that. And the fact of the matter is that any kind of significant change of their policy right now of increased liquidity or draining liquidity out of the markets would really be very painful because we are seeing that margin levels and leveraging of accounts are pretty high. And at the same time, note that liquidity is still very high. All that adds up to an interesting phenomena for stock markets. As a matter of fact, I have a good question that came in, and this is actually one of several that came in about interest rates and about policy and conversations that listeners have been writing into me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com, you know, but saying, hey, Andrew, what is the story with markets? Why are we seeing them continually going up, even in the face of bad news? And we'll get to Jason's discussion in a moment. But overall, we did see that Mario Draghi also did speak and said that, hey, there's more tools, more things that they could do, more policy tweaks and changes and additions that can be made to ensure that there will be a recovery in Europe. We are seeing that Germany, of course, is falling pretty dramatically in terms of their economy because of their close relationship with Russia, and all the sanctions that have been and will be and are ongoing have been hurting them. And many of the developed countries in Europe are feeling a lot of the pain. And as such, not only does Mario Draghi have the job of reinflating, but also protecting the economies there. The dollar, on the other hand, with all of that was said and the idea that the economy in the U.S. is getting better, did have a great rally over the last several weeks. And as a matter of fact, it's the highest level against the euro since 2012. If you recall, when Mario Draghi did the negative interest rates on bank deposits at the central bank and tried his best to bring the euro down by talking it down and throwing the kitchen sink essentially at the markets in terms of all of his policy measures, the euro didn't blink. The dollar kept on going down because there was the thought at that time that the dollar would still continue on its downslide that we'd seen for some time. But then when we saw the safety trade start to pick up a little bit because of the geopolitical issues around the world, whether it's the Mideast or Russia or, you know, what's happening in the China Sea, the fact is that the dollar is still the place that people will go. And add that to the fact of all the things that are happening in terms of policy in Europe, contrasting that to the United States, the dollar has been moving higher. And we're seeing gold and silver stabilize, but really have a pretty rough week. Gold, in fact, was down. It was up Friday, but it was down for the week. There was some real rough movements on it, down 1.5% or so for the week, which I think is quite amazing. The fact of the matter is that people are still buying bonds, even though there is this large outcry about the fact that bonds are going to be a major catastrophe moving forward. If, in fact, we do see the dollar increasing, the economy getting better, the Fed moving out, the fact that interest rates will move higher, there's going to be a major, quote-unquote, collapse in bonds. You hear it from advisors everywhere, money managers, hedge fund managers, everybody's talking about the ultimate collapse of some of the rates, moving them higher, and the prices moving lower. It hasn't happened. 10-year still at 2.4 and change. A little bit of movement to the upside, but nothing major. Still a lot of buying there. The question is why? Is it because simply, well, the Fed is here to stay, or is it something more? Is it that there's concern? Well, if there was, we didn't see the markets really react on the equity side very much. So we are seeing that there is a controversy in the markets, but that has been still showing a melt up of equities. People are still looking to buy equities, particularly the large cap. And in a way, really not being very much, excited about the small cap universe. Interest rates rising will hurt small caps more than they will the large caps, in particular because a lot of the large caps these days have dividends that protect some of the gains. So people that are looking for a way to get both growth and income have the opportunity to buy many of the large caps at a decent rate. As a matter of fact, if you look at the Dow and the S&P, the interest rate, the dividend yield, is the highest it's been in a very long time, and maybe in years, with the fact that the PE is as high. So a lot of times you'll see that when markets or stocks come down in price, the yield goes up. What we're seeing is yield is going up and price is going up, meaning that there is more dividends paid really than ever before on stocks. And that's a function of two things. One, stocks and boards know that, you know, people are looking for yield. They're appealing to those people that are looking for the yield component. And if you can get 3% on a stock and, you know, you can get on a CD 1%, well, which way are you going to go, especially if you have the Fed behind you? So a lot of this is making its way through the markets, and the realization is that the yields on equities have been so substantial that it makes it for a very good investment, both on a long-term basis and short-term in terms of some of the safety issues. It may be wise to buy equities with a high yield compared to a small cap if we are going to see the interest rates move higher and if we're going to see geopolitical issues. Think about that for a second. Very much opposite of what it used to be in terms of equities would go down initially on any geopolitical risk and stay down. Well, now you can buy the yield on it, and it's kind of like a quasi-replacement or addition to maybe a bond. You get both sides of it. It's like a preferred stock in a way. A couple of things of note before we get to our guest. Number one, Apple. We're still seeing some news that Apple is going to be having a major announcement on the 9th of September about their next iPhone. I personally can't wait. I'm still sitting on an iPhone 4S waiting for the 6 to come out. And there is some discussion that is saying that there will be a smartwatch announcement at that time as well. But there's other discussions saying there's some glitches and some things and some delays that the smartwatch may not be right away. Still, the iPhone 6, the whole idea of this new phone, which is going to be larger or choices of being a larger phone, is really hitting the markets pretty well. And Apple has hit an all-time high, and it's above the $100 level nicely and comfortably. And don't forget, they still have tremendous amount of cash on their balance sheets, and they are having the continuation of their $30 billion stock buyback program. One of the things you want to watch next week is durable goods. There's a bunch of things that will be coming out over the next week. You have durable goods, I believe housing. You'll see some numbers there on the Case-Shiller. You'll see the consumer confidence levels all in the last week of the month that you usually see. And one of the things that you want to note is that durable goods is going to see some potentially pretty astounding growth numbers. One of the things that happened in July was there was a slew of orders in for the Boeing 777, and those come in and will hit the durable goods orders. Now, that will be the headline number, which will include everything, durable goods. You may see something like a 15% increase on a month-over-month basis of durable goods. That will be pretty impressive. Now, if you strip out the transportation, which would be, of course, the planes that we're talking about here, you may only see about a 0.2, a 0.3. So pay attention to not only the number that you see on the headline, but what's below the numbers, the actual durable goods stripped of transportation. That's going to be something we want to watch. You're going to probably see some crazy market action when this number comes out. I'm not sure if we're going to see an incredibly sharp down move because it's so good, and that is going to be a very big concern. And then a pickup that people said, well, if it's so good, hey, that's a good thing. And, you know, it goes into whatever calculation about the production of the economy overall. But just pay attention to that. After it settles down, look at the number beneath the number, which is the durable goods ex transportation. Watch that. We're also going to be watching Case-Shiller, and we are seeing that there has been some better numbers recently on the housing, which, of course, is a major component of the U.S. economy. We want to see that really moving well because you have banking that is an adjunct to that. You have the construction spending. You have housing spending. You have fix-ups. You have all the different things that go into the play of the housing market. You saw that Home Depot came out with great earnings last week. There's a new CEO as well. The stock hit an all-time high and moved very nicely, and Lowe's came out also. They were a little bit disappointing, but buyers stepped in after the number, even though the stock was down 2.5%, 3%, and bid the stock higher. The opportunity for the companies in the area that are related to housing with a better-than-expected NAHB, the sentiment index that you have for builders last week out, as well as the fact that you had better numbers on pending, and we saw some existing home numbers and new home sales numbers come out that were pretty good, and this was a big change from what we saw only a couple of months ago where things were falling down pretty miserably. I'm not sure if there was a backlog during that time where there was a higher interest rate and we had some weather issues, and then all of a sudden rates were down and people said, okay, now they're down. I'm going back in again. I'm not going to wait any longer to buy a house because we're seeing that interest rates are so low, it's almost irresistible. So use that and think about that for what's going on in the next week. I would say that dependent on really what's going on in Ukraine and when we see that the numbers and discussions and policy efforts that were discussed over Jackson Hole over the weekend will be absorbed, it would seem to me that we need to see a little bit more consolidation in this market. And frankly, I think that we have a little bit of a high mark set for a little while here. It may see it drift a little bit higher, but And that's due to the sentiment that's going on right now that the markets will never go down again. If you probably can feel that and kind of smell that out there. But yet at the same time, there is some underlying issues that really need to be contended with. And as such, I think that we are going to see the potential for a continuation of what we've seen, but yet some reality is going to be smacking us in the face very shortly in terms of valuation levels of many of these stocks. Let's get to our guest. How's that? And then we'll come back and talk about some of the things that were sent to me, some of the email by listeners, a couple of them that I have that I want to talk about, and we'll go from there. And our special guest today is Ronnie Moaz. He is with Standpoint Research, and he also has a special website and a passion. It's philanthropyandphilosophy.com. We'll talk more about that in a moment. And some things that I think you'll find some very interesting points about some of his commentary. Ronnie, how are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you for having me.
So, you know, actually, you were in on the front page of the South Florida Business Journal, I think just last week or this week. And the commentary underneath it, first of all, it had your picture and it had the word blacklisted, the blacklist, and the commentary that you want to have capitalism work for everyone. Give me a little bit of an explanation of what you mean by that.
We have right now a situation where the top 1% of the world population is controlling 65 times what the bottom half of the world population has. We have a situation right now where half of the world population is living on less than $4 a day. You don't get to the top of the mountain without stepping on people along the way. And the biggest corporations in this country, and that is exactly what they're doing. You take Starbucks, for example. The millionaire and billionaire shareholders are sitting on $50 billion worth of stock. And the bean pickers in Central America are working in 100-degree heat for $4 a day. You have the market capitalization of Walmart near $250 billion. And their workers are getting paid $9 an hour while we subsidize their wages via food stamps. And I can go on and on. CVS, the CEO, is now making 500 times what his cashiers are making. They make $9 an hour. He's making 500 times what they make. And the profit margin is not enough to keep his shareholders happy. So he's replacing the cashiers with checkout kiosks and kicking the workers to the street so that their bottom line will be fatter and he can get a higher bonus and his shareholders can make more money than what they already have. And I can go on and on again with Amazon and Apple and Philip Morris. It's just a common theme with vulture capitalism where the only thing that matters is how much money you make at the end of the day, and it doesn't matter what you do to your employees along the way in order to get that bottom line where the shareholders want it.
But Ronnie, whose fault is that? Is it the fault of the management of a company, because you said the management of the company, the one making more of the money, and the employees and the people that are doing the work or not, of course, or is it the entire shape of our current market system that is dictating that, hey, you know what, we want margins to increase, we want growth to increase, we want to have more money, you know, drop to the bottom line on revenue. I mean, you know, where is this coming from? Because on one hand, I think I could see what you're saying, that, hey, you know what, you got greedy bastards at the top that are making all this money at the expense of all the others. On the other hand, it's being allowed because essentially shareholders are desirous of this, right? The owners of the company.
Well, that's the problem. The shareholders don't give a damn about anybody but themselves. They don't give a damn about the employees. And without the employees, you wouldn't have a business. CVS could have paid a $5,000 bonus to every one of their 100,000 employees last year and still made $4 billion. But the shareholders want $5 billion,
right,
and they want the employees to starve to death.
As a matter of fact,
and we also have a problem with the consumer. The consumer is not boycotting companies that are mistreating their employees. The third richest man in the world right now is the founder of Zara. Okay? He's worth $65 billion.
Mm-hmm.
He has 100,000 employees. He could give every one of them $500,000 right now and still be left with $15 billion in his pocket. But instead, he's using workers in Bangladesh, paying them $2 a day, And that's where Americans are shopping. Instead of shopping at American Apparel, which is a company that pays their employees in Los Angeles $12 an hour, gives them health care benefits, subsidized lunches for $3, and free massages. Okay? Wow. And that company is close to bankruptcy right now. Yeah. Because Americans are not supporting companies that are treating their employees. Right. We just want stuff cheap at Walmart, and it doesn't matter how it's being produced.
Well, and a lot of that has to do with the very, I won't say it's cultural. I'll say it's, I won't even say it's philosophical. It is, at this point, inbred that it's a me society, a me world. And you know what? I got to watch out for myself. Therefore, if I'm going to go shopping for something, I want to find the cheapest thing. And not only that, the advent of the internet has allowed for comparison shopping where there's a lot more, I would call it, visibility and transparency to pricing. So therefore, it makes the whole idea of shopping a process of going for a commodity, if you will, to find the cheapest of what it is. I mean, I know that I do that. You know, if I'm looking for something, whatever it may be, I'm going to say, okay, you know what? I'll go out and find it. The old days, way back when, if I was buying shoes, there was a couple of stores in town that you'd go to, right? Now, I can go to those stores, but I can also go on the internet and find it cheaper. Somebody selling it cheaper somewhere. But I guess the point is that you have this philosophy, okay, and I got you, I hear that, but it is 180 degrees, or maybe even 360, I don't know. It's way out of the same kind of characteristics that we're looking for in terms of corporate America. And you're really focusing on corporate America, but also you're focusing on the cause of that. But you know, you blacklist these companies that have, as you would call it, I guess, irresponsible pay scales and that are not paying their employees in terms of health care and all the other things that go along with that, right? And you have a list of these that make these egregious types of decisions to really not benefit their employees. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So you have this list. Now, what do you do with that list? Do you say, hey, these are companies that should be shorted? Or just the fact is that, okay, these are bad companies, you just put that out? I mean, what's the point of it?
Well, I'm trying to change the way people think, okay? You know, the president in 1891 was Benjamin Harrison, okay? 1891, that's 124 years ago. And he once said, and this is 124 years ago, he says, I pity the man who wants a coat so cheap that the man or woman who produces the cloth will starve in the process.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people need to listen to something like that. I pity the man who wants a coat so cheap that the man or woman who produces the cloth will starve in the process. We need to stop thinking about ourselves and start thinking about people that are suffering. You see what's going on in Ferguson, Missouri right now?
No, I hear you.
That's not about a kid that got shot. It's about it's a lot of frustration building up amongst people at the bottom of the pyramid who are treated like slaves. We have not made any progress in the last 150 years since slavery was abolished. We still have people working 60, 70, 80 hours a week, and they can't even make it to the end of the month on the money that they're getting paid. Nobody working 40, 50 hours a week should be living at, near, or below a poverty line when we're in the richest country in the world. We have a situation right now where the 100 wealthiest people in the world have more money than the bottom half of the world population. And anyone that could look at that statistic and argue against wealth redistribution needs to get their head checked.
Yeah, but this is going to take
and more people. And I think what the game changer is here is social media. There are now tens of millions of people online complaining about these things that I'm complaining about. That, you know, so the poor people have a voice now for the first time. No one would let a McDonald's worker go on television and complain about his paycheck. But now these people can complain via the internet, and there are these grassroots movements popping up online, and they have hundreds of thousands and in some cases millions of followers. And I think within the next few years you're going to see a shift in the direction that I'm hoping to push people. I'm trying to change their awareness, increase activism, change their consciousness, you know, call their attention to how they're spending their money, who they're spending their money with, And we have to stop looking up at people that are living in $20 million homes with $5 million yachts, $200,000 cars, $20,000 handbags, $2,000 pair of shoes, and start looking up to people that are giving their money away when anything is coming in that they don't need to cover their basic living expenses.
You know, that list that you just made, did you happen to see my financials? Is that what you were quoting? Because I have most of the things on your list. No, I'm kidding.
I'm sorry?
I'm kidding. I was saying I had most of the things on that list, the $200,000 car.
Oh. No, I didn't hear you right.
So now,
but my whole point, I wanted to just make one more point. I'm in Miami Beach. I see people driving down Ocean Drive in these $200,000 automobiles, okay? If I have $200,000, I'm not buying an automobile. I'm buying 20,000 pairs of shoes and putting them on the feet of children that have no shoes in this world. I'm not blowing $200,000 on a car. I'm 47 years old. I never even got a driver's license.
Oh.
And I've managed just fine without a driver's license.
But let's focus focus back here for a second. There is the possibility that you could have a $200,000 car and you could also give the shoes away. That's possible, right?
Yeah, that's it. If somebody is that, somebody wants something, you know, that badly, I'm not going to judge someone like that. But there has to be a proportion between what that person is spending on themselves and what they're giving back to society.
Okay, well, this goes back to, like, religion, for example. So I'm Jewish, and you look at Judaism, you look at, Christianity and all that, and there's something called tithing, and there's something called tzedakah, and you give money back, and that's kind of part of the way of being that, you know, if you're so fortunate to make for whatever reason, then you give a little back to the community. You know, that is clearly something that obviously is on your philanthropy and philosophy.com site, but I need to kind of focus in back to McDonald's for a second. So if McDonald's is paying, let's just say, you know, you're saying they're making these people work hard for a living that is under the amount they should be making, and let's call it, instead of $10 an hour, let's say $15 an hour. Let's just say that's the number, okay? The $5 per hour, which may not seem like a lot, what does that do? And whether or not you care about this or not, I want to talk about what it does to the overall expense ratio of the company, and thereby, what does it do to the stock price and the profitability? And where in the big scheme of things is that important?
Well, the situation is that I am not necessarily asking for a hike in the minimum wage, okay? And that is something that I need to make clear here. If you raise the minimum wage, you're going to put some businesses out of business. There are going to be other businesses that lay workers off or cut back on their hiring. I am fighting for wealth redistribution, okay, which means taking money from the top and subsidizing the wages of those people that are making less than $15 an hour. All right. I just went to a place yesterday for dinner. There were 7 or 8 African-American workers behind the counter. They were all making minimum wage, and I calculated in my head that the landlord of that Shake Shack store, okay, was collecting more money a month in rent than all of those workers were getting combined at the end of their month with their paychecks. So the landlord of the store was making more than all of the 8 African-American employees put together.
Well,
and that's not right.
Again, it doesn't matter the color, it doesn't matter the creed, it doesn't matter anything like that, right? Let's be honest,
it doesn't matter.
I'm saying it doesn't matter the color, the creed, whatever it is. The fact is you're really focusing on the financials, but I'm still trying to understand something because with all due respect, okay, the way that this whole game is played right now and the way it's rigged and it's all created to go is that whether you have a lot of money or a little money, whether or not you're investing a lot or a little, the fact of the matter is people want to own a piece of a profitable company. Now, I understand that there are components of that company or let's say a restaurant. You know, you have to pay rent. You have to pay for the food. You have to pay for the electricity. You have all these different things you have to pay for, right? And inclusive of the cost of employees and all that. Now, let me just make a segue for a second here in that for a number of years, I have seen the advent of we'll call it robotics or other non-human type of employment. For example, if you just drive, you don't drive, but if you drive up and down the Florida Turnpike, for example, you used to have all these people taking your money. You know, you get a ticket, then you'd stand in line, and you wait in line, and you pay a little bit, and you go, and then you get the next one, and you, okay, now it's the Sun Pass. And if you don't have the Sun Pass, by the way, they'll take a picture of your driver's license and send you a bill. Point is that all of those toll takers are out of business, you know, and there's a whole entire structural issue when it comes to employment right now, because there is so much emphasis put on companies making money and this wealth effect. Now, the wealth effect doesn't affect everybody, but a lot of people have 401ks and they have some money in savings and stocks and things like that. I don't really get how we can put a number on some of this. I mean, you know, if you have $15 an hour here, well, in New York, the higher there's a much higher cost of living in California and D.C. versus, let's say, in Arkansas versus.
No. When I talk about $15, I'm talking about, you know, making it adjusted for the cost of living in each particular state.
Okay.
So in one state it would be $16, in another state it would be $18. And again, I am not necessarily asking for a raise in minimum wage. I'm asking to take money from the people at the very top and subsidize the wages of the people that are making less than $15 an hour. Okay, I understand that raising minimum wage could backfire on society, mm-hmm. but that's not what I'm asking for.
Okay, I got you. So
we need wealth redistribution. We need to shut the tax loopholes down, mm-hmm. and we need to have these people start carrying their own weight and giving back to society that they've taken so much from.
So you're not really – maybe can I refine this for you for a second? Maybe it's not that you're blacklisting a company. Follow me here. Maybe it's you're blacklisting the management, the people at the top. Is that a better way to look at this?
I'm upset at everybody. I'm also upset at the people that are shopping in these places that are abusing their employees. So it's just a whole cult. I'm trying to change the way people think, which hasn't really changed in 2,000 years. And it's not easy to do, but there's a difference doing it now versus 50 or 100 or 200 years ago, and that is we have the internet. And now the poor people that are disgruntled have a voice. And I think if social media is used properly, we may be able to change the way people think and how they consume and how they look at life.
Well,
and that's what I'm hoping.
Let me throw this out at you.
18 hours a day right now.
Let me throw this out at you, okay?
Yeah.
Let me kind of pose this question to you or the situation, okay?
Yeah.
Companies are not going to change. Just follow me here. Companies are not going to change unless the responsibility of the company for what they do and their actions, okay, is then put upon the people that are out there rather than the stock market, okay? For example, would we agree that a company right now as it stands is responsible to its shareholders, to its owners? Would you agree with that?
Yes, that's what they are. They only care about their shareholders.
That's what it is right now.
Employees are secondary.
But I'm trying
to flip that.
But how is that going to be? Because I don't really understand. I don't see how it's possible. And I'm not trying to be very argumentative here, but I just don't. I'm not getting it through my head here. And I'm not saying, by the way, your thoughts and your commentary and your whole discussion here is not something I'd like to see. Right? You know what I'm saying? I mean, obviously, I'd like to see that people have shoes, and I'd like to people have running water and clean water and medicines. I mean, the whole list goes on. I got that. Okay, I'm with you. But what I'm trying to say is, I don't know how you're going to change the paradigm if companies' current responsibility is for the owners of any company, any size, and particularly those that are traded on the exchanges and that have active shares on the market, unless you have something that is major that comes in, and like you said, maybe a strike. Listen, you can go around the world and you could find coffee. May cost you in some parts of the world 25 cents for a little quick espresso, and you go to a Starbucks and $6 or $5 or whatever it is for a cup of coffee. That's absurd. Now, that's with the current scenario. That's with the current cost of things. That, you know, but I guess the point is that you're going to have, as you said, some major social changes, in that there are boycotts in a very significant manner to get this going, because people are just kind of creatures of habit doing what they've done all along. And between commercials on TV, between you know, all the things that go along, nobody seems to care about any of that. I don't think anybody sees that if they get a cheap pair of sneakers, there's some kid in China that is 12 years old that can't go to school because their family demands they work for $1 a day.
I want to tell you something. People at the top will not change, okay, until they realize that it's more costly not to change. At the end of 2013, Apple was sitting on $150 billion in cash, and their stock market valuation was $600 billion. And at the same time that their market capitalization was topping a half a trillion dollars, there were employees on the assembly lines in China committing suicide.
Mm-hmm.
How on earth can anyone with a clear conscience buy a product from a company that is treating their employees this way?
Well, what's the alternative? Obviously, you know, besides the fact that we all want a smartphone, what's the alternative? I mean, is there a
company? The alternative is to threaten Apple that if they don't start treating their employees fairly, you're not going to buy their products anymore. That's what we have to do.
Yeah, well. Unfortunately, I hear you. I get it.
What is their defense? That they can't afford to pay the workers in Asia $6 or $7 or $8 an hour? What's their defense?
I don't know. I mean, I know that
can't break the rules in this country, so they go where they can break the rules.
Well,
if they treated their employees in America the way they treat their employees in Asia, they would be thrown in jail right now.
Right. And one of the reasons that there is a lot of companies right now that are leaving China is because a lot of the people there have realized that they want more. They want more pay. They want things like insurance. They want better benefits. They want off, you know, vacation time and all that. And what's happening is now, for example, we saw the incredible move of, for example, call centers over the last number of years that used to be in India, and now they've moved to the Philippines because
exactly what is going on. We are in a race to the bottom, and it's not going to end until these companies find workers in Africa for less than 50 cents a day. That's the direction we're getting right now. When is this going to stop? When they get free labor? So what? I don't understand what's going on here. When is it going to stop?
Yeah,
there needs to be some
exactly
kind of international standards where you're paying a minimum wage that is consistent based on the cost of living across different countries, so you don't have this shift of labor from China to Vietnam and now Bangladesh, which is the lowest cost producer right now. And that's where Zara is, and that's why the owner of Zara, like I opened up this interview with, is the third wealthiest person in the world. Because he's going to Bangladesh, where instead of paying the workers $4, $5, $6 a day, he's paying them $2 a day.
Right. Now, but just to get back to something, the blacklist for a moment, the fact is that the blacker the company is in terms of on your list, okay, the more cost effective, and again, I'm not saying this is good, I'm just saying fact, okay, the more cost effective they are, the better their margins probably are, and the higher multiple they'll get in the markets. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
I mean, that's a sad
capitalism. That's vulture capitalism.
Yeah. It's a sad commentary, but it's a fact. I mean, and the truth of the matter is, I would almost say, as crazy as it may be to you, but if you took your blacklist, it would almost be like, hey, from a raw standard of just finding companies that do really well with their expenses, I'm not saying good or bad, not making a commentary on that. Those are the companies probably that will have good margins, better earnings over time, et cetera. Again, not saying they're good companies or anything like that, but those are the companies. The fact is that I think that, you know, obviously there needs to be something here. Now, redistribution of wealth.
Well, the flip side of what you said is true, unfortunately. And the flip side of that is that if you invest in the companies that are socially responsible, your returns will not be that good. Just look at what happened to American Apparel.
Well,
The market value dropped by 85%.
Yeah, but the CEO was doing some weird stuff also.
Well, that had nothing to do with it. The main problem is that, you know, he's working and he's manufacturing in the United States and he's treating his employees fairly, and he can't compete with those kinds of expenses with someone like Zara that's using sweatshops in Asia.
Mm. Well, unfortunately, the whole entire economy in the U.S. revolves around the consumer, revolves around buying things, revolves around credit. And it's all geared to have more, 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 more. I got to tell you something. I recently moved from...
And excuse me to interrupt you, but more of stuff that we don't even need.
That's what I was going to tell you. I recently moved, and there was a day that I got into my house, and all the things were being packed up. And I looked at my wife. I said, where were we? Where was all this stuff? I mean, where do we keep this stuff? I don't even remember seeing this stuff for years. And it kind of dawned on me like, wow, wait a minute. What's going on here? There's every once in a while... You're going to buy something that's a duplicate of something else. I get that, you know, and maybe you can't find something that's lost and you buy something. But it was almost like, wait a minute, how come I have all this stuff that I don't need? I gave away an entire truckload, truly truckload, you know, one of those half-size trucks to charity. I took it all. I said, you know, just take this from me. And, you know, I felt good about it. They did good with it. But the point was that why did I have that to begin with was another whole discussion, you know. You know, one of the things I also do is from time to time when I need some technology or something of that nature, I personally find that when I look to the ability and the cost effectiveness of people, let's say I have Pakistan and Russia and India and a few other places around, I found that I'm getting a really good, I get a real benefit from not only the cost of that, but also the brain power that's behind it. You know, what do I do about that?
Yeah.
I mean, is that something that I should shy away from?
I'm sorry, I missed that.
I said that point. I work with people from Pakistan and Russia and India for technology support sometimes. What should I do about that? I'm paying them far less than I would pay.
Oh, no, I don't have any problem with outsourcing. I outsource myself. I have analysts in India that have been helping me for years because I can't afford American analysts, and they don't take advantage of me and use me as a stepping stone the way the people in India do. I don't have any problem with people outsourcing as long as they're paying those workers outside the country a very fair wage. And I pay my analysts in India very well. I could be getting them for half as much as what they asked me for. Okay, but I'm sorry, but I give them double what they asked me for,
right?
Because I can afford to, and I think it's the right thing to do. I'm not trying, you know, I could pay my housekeeper $60 every time she comes here, and she'd be perfectly happy. But I give her double that. And that's my whole point. If people can afford to pay their workers better, and, you know, you only need one fork to eat with, okay? If you're making a lot of money, why not let something trickle down to the people at the bottom? You know, people talk about trickle-down economic theories. It's BS. There is no trickle-down. The only thing that's trickling down from what I see are food stamps and breadcrumbs. Everything is going to the people at the top of the pyramid, and the people in the bottom two-thirds are basically servicing these people and making their lives as comfortable as they are. And the people at the top just don't appreciate. They are undervaluing these people, and it's indefensible.
Tell me a little bit more about
the way that some people live compared to the way the people at the bottom in the services sector live.
So tell me something. Let's finish up with tell me a little bit about the whole idea behind philanthropy and philosophy.com.
Oh, okay. Well, I deal with wealthy institutions and individuals. I am the number one ranked independent research provider on Wall Street the last 6 years, audited. And I always ask my clients, how come you don't give money to charity, more money to charity? And the common answer that I get most often is that they don't believe the money that they're giving is getting to the poor. So what I did is I set up a website, and that eliminates this argument from the equation completely. I went through thousands of organizations and charities. I identified the top 24 organizations. These are the most honest, transparent, and efficient organizations in the world. Every one of them is doing God's work. And for every one of these organizations, I put a 3 to 4 page report for each of them on my website. So when people go there, it's not a question of whether or not you are going to give. It's just a question of how many of these organizations you will be supporting. Because these companies get the money that you're sending them directly to where it is intended when you're making the donation.
Interesting. All right, Ronnie Moas from StandpointResearch.com, also philanthropy and philosophy.com. I appreciate the information that you're sharing, and the concept and the work that you're doing to equalize, if you will, or better distribute some of the wealth and kind of create a better world. I think that's admirable. Again, I'd like to see how it happens when you have this whole thing set up and so stacked in favor of the companies rather than the employees. But, you know, maybe social media, like you said, will do something. So I appreciate you coming aboard today.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, Ronnie. Now, I'm sure that there's going to be plenty of feedback on that because, you know, there's people who out there believe that clearly the shareholders, the owners of the companies, are the ones that the company should be really taking care of. And the earnings and the profitability of a company is the number one issue that is really important to a company and to shareholders and to investors, etc. On the other hand, there's going to be a lot of people, I'm sure, that say, you know, wait a minute. Yeah, but what level? What means it? What? Who do we step on? Who do we, you know, who do we destroy to get to this level of earnings? And what happens one day when companies become so automated that there are no employees? Well, it's a matter of how the markets will move right now. And I'd love to hear what you have to say about that. Send me an email at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Anything you want to say, and I really want to hear what you have to say about this, whether or not the responsibility of the company is to the employees or if it's to the shareholders or anything in between. And I'll read that on the air next week. So make sure you get those to me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Now, there was a number of conversations that were sent to me and questions about the whole idea about what is going on with the markets. Everybody's calling for a correction. There's all this going on right now, and you know what? Well, Jason writes me from LA. He writes me, he says, "Hey, Andrew, with everyone calling for a correction of anywhere from 5 to 20%, I came up with a theory as to why the bull market continues and buying on dips will continue. I finally realized one simple thing: interest rates. That's it. Disregard geopolitical events, disregard politics, disregard earnings. It comes down to this. As long as interest rates stay low, the market is not going to have any substantial sell-offs more than maybe 3 or 4%. If that, historically low interest rates have always brought much higher market valuations, and this time is no exception, especially when rates are the lowest we'll see in our lifetime. Short-term rate is basically almost zero. That equals free money and massive liquidity. As long as a 10-year is below 275 to 3, the market is not going to see it as any substantial problem or see pullbacks. And because we're not seeing any dramatic improvements in the U.S. economy, we'll be stuck in the sweet spot for some time to come. There'll be a time," and he goes on to say, "there will be time to short, but that's not now. But while the 10-year is at 2.37 or 2.4, in the meantime, equities go higher, probably much higher. In fact, right now may be one of the best times to go long as we've ever seen. And we are nowhere near irrational exuberance." Hey, thanks, Jay. I will tell you, and I would agree with you, that clearly the idea that, quote, "don't fight the Fed" is what you're talking about. The Fed is doing what they can to increase the wealth effect. They're doing what they can to provide as much liquidity and money out there for people who will utilize it for any means, whether they're going to go out there and buy a home or borrow money as a company to expand or to hire, or whatever they're going to do to refinance possibly and cut down their cost and then have more money to spend. That's all great. Interestingly enough, the banks also in this low interest rate environment are making more profits than ever. Kind of fascinating if you think about that. And at the same time, you're not seeing any inflation because, once again, we're seeing that gigantic hole that needed to be filled, and the competition, it's a big issue, the competition on a global basis is really holding down the price increases when it comes to the official inflation numbers. And again, we all know that a lot of things are costing more and more. Chemical prices have gone up dramatically. You know, you go to a Home Depot and you look at paint prices, or you look at plumbing supplies, or you look at plastics, or you look at chemicals, or you look at anything really that's out there that you and I spend our money on, whether it's coffee from Starbucks, whether it's the clothes that we wear, generally speaking, it's a lot more money overall. And people are having to make a lot more money, but at the same time, they're doing so because the opportunities are there and the low cost of getting into a business or expanding your business or keeping your business going and the net dropping down is beneficial. At the same time, we kind of harken back to our guest that was with us, Ronnie, and talking about how companies are also taking that and adding to the fact that they're not paying more and wage growth is really benign, if existing at all. So I agree with you, Jason, that the low interest rate environment is a major contributor, a tremendous contributor to the growth. And yes, you do see that stocks will have a greater valuation placed on them during this time, especially if they have a yield that is higher than anything you get anywhere else, which we talked about at the beginning of the show. So yes, I do believe you are correct. The question is, and maybe not for now, but the question is, those companies that cannot produce, expand, and increase their margins, their revenues and their net to the bottom line. In this kind of environment, what happens when and if interest rates go up to them? In addition to that, when liquidity is pulled, and it will, everything cycles. This happens to be a longer cycle than usual with the interest rates that they are, because if we had one of the greatest, if not the second largest, you know, recession, depression, whatever you want to call it, in history, just a couple of years, few years back, that we're still working our way out of. And not to mention the fact that globally we're so well integrated that everything that happens over there happens over here. The old butterfly effect, you know? When a butterfly flaps its wings in China, you get a hurricane somewhere in Tibet or in the United States. So there's a lot of things that are happening on a global basis that is feeding much of the action in the markets. And on top of that, the central banks around the world, for the most part, are very dovish and are all synchronized by providing a low interest rate. So I do think that you have a very good point there and observation more than a question in this. I guess the big question that you'd have to ask at the end of this is when and what, how much, how fast. And at this point, I think that the Fed is doing their best to keep us all very much in the loop of what's going on and not trying to spook the markets, because that's a very major component of what they are looking to do, which is simply to increase the valuations of assets and reinflate economies, not only through equities and financial assets, but also through commodities, which hasn't worked tremendously in their favor. But yet, if you have commodities that are not inflating and you do have financial assets that are inflating, the only component you really need to make it the perfect combination is wage growth. That's the one thing that we're not seeing. And again, this all ties back to the whole conversation that we're having in this particular episode when it comes to Ronnie's discussion of the blacklist and companies that are not actually increasing their earnings and really taking everything out on the top end and the low end. The employees are really just getting the shaft as far as he's concerned in his discussion. So this all ties together in terms of creating a much better environment for equities, no question. I've been quite surprised how resilient equities have been in the face of bonds not being purchased and the quantitative easing program being slowed down to only $10 billion and about to shut off in October, supposedly. And it's very surprising. But at the same time, you have to realize something. The United States companies are not only resilient, but extraordinarily creative. And as such, they have the entire globe to utilize as their potential. And right now, the M&A activity that we're seeing and the deals that are being done for strategic alliances and acquisitions that are happening, very, very smart. Maybe it's a sign that it's the end of the market bull that we've seen when all this is going on, when there's a search for growth outside of a company's basic tenets of what they do. But at the same time, it is something that is to be, I think, reckoned with, that companies can do this and it is beneficial to shareholders. So thanks for that. Again, you could write me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. For those of you that sent some stuff in and wanted, we had a good grouping of people that wanted information on Arrow, our algorithmic strategy that is in on the S&P when there's a long signal or short or out. Three different possibilities, long, short, or neutral. We did have a glitch in some of the data and materials that were going out, so hopefully those were sent out to you in the last couple of days. If you do want information on that, it's a $50,000 minimum. You can go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and check it out and look at all the different strategies. You can find out how the performance of the Arrow strategy over the last 15 years that we tested and went through and designed has been just tremendous. Not always going to be great, but you know, that's how investments go. Check it out. I think you'll be very interested. And that's all about all we have for this particular episode. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you again real soon. Next week, DH Unplugged. Don't forget to listen to that on Wednesdays and Tuesday nights. And I'll see you and hear from you. And thanks for all the feedback that you've been giving me. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.